All right, so tonight class is, when is enough enough? Yeah. We're going to explain that.
What movie is this?
Because I opened the... Well, you're going to find out.
Is it from... Oh, I know what you're thinking.
Milkshake machine salesman. Build a fast food empire with 1,600 restaurants and annual revenue of $700 million. One word. Persistence.
Thanks, Castle Sales.
How'd you do? Hey, how'd you do? Good. Well, a lot of interest.
We got an order.
We wanted something different. And that's when our brother here comes up with one of his brilliant ideas. Orders ready in 30 seconds, not 30 minutes. Meat original is nothing like this.
Revolutionary.
Exactly. It's revolutionary. What is that? Golden Arches. It's a way to make the place stand out.
There should be McDonald's everywhere. Franchise the damn thing.
Mr. Crow.
Franchise.
McDonald's can be the new American church. And it ain't just open on Sundays, boys.
I am flesh and I am bone. Rise up, ting ting, like little rainbow.
How can we be almost on the capital?
Did you mortgage our home? You would lose everything.
How do I renegotiate? My lousy deal.
But can Gander won't break.
What?
No!
Oh, damn it. What you ought to be doing is owning the land upon which that burger is cooked. You're not in the burger business. You're in the real estate business.
Franchise Realty Corporation.
It's its own separate company, which puts it outside your purview.
There's a wolf in the hen house. We let him in.
Is enough going to be enough for you?
Probably never. You are to stop this instant and through taking orders from me.
You have a contract.
Contracts are like hearts. They're made to be broken.
That was great.
Business is war. It's dog eat dog, rat eat rat. I want to take the future. I want to win.
The brother's your business partner. You make it go away. I don't care what it takes. That glorious name, McDonald's. I had to have it.
You don't have it. You sure about that?
Okay, well, that's... Can I put the light back on? That's a movie called The Founder. It's a great movie.
You saw it?
I did see it. I give it a Rabbit Roll thumbs up. Now you get a nice good. Hi, Jenna. I can't hear you, but all right.
Hi, Rabbi.
How are you doing? Welcome. We just played the video, so if you got a chance to see the video before, whatever, we're going to talk about it now.
Yeah, I saw the video.
Okay, good. That's beautiful. Okay. We got time there. All right. You guys hear me? You guys hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Okay. We're going to continue. All right. All right, question, guys. So the movie's about Ray Kroc. Ray Kroc was the person who didn't actually start McDonald's. The McDonald's brothers started McDonald's. And they had one store. And he, of course, expanded out to, you know, thousands and thousands of stores, making a multi-billion-dollar business. At the end, he sort of cheated them, you know, sort of that. So I don't know, but the Michael Keaton, who does a phenomenal job as an actor, he's a phenomenal actor. So give you a little taste. First of all, raise your hand if you've seen the movie, if you saw the movie. Oh, we got one.
No.
Me and you, man.
Let's do it, baby.
All right. Is it good for, all right. Anyways, so you saw the clip. But clearly, what he see was Ray Kroc's greatness. It does come through the clip. What was his greatness?
He was a visionary.
Visionary.
Manipulating the system.
Yes.
Very
motivating. Motivating. All right. So he's a driven, motivated, visionary. Opportunist, you know, he is insistent, consistent, and most importantly, persistent. Okay, this guy is not only, and how much did he, you got a little taste in the clip, he was so, this idea, this fast food idea, which didn't exist before, he even mortgage his house. That's why he saw his first wife. He also saw a little allusion that basically he met one of his franchisee's wives and basically seduced her, and he adultery, you know, a lot of, that gets into our next question. What is Ray Kroc's weakness, which is basically a feature of all these elements?
Manipulator.
Okay.
Massive ego.
Yes.
Impulsive.
A little impulsive, but not so impulsive, because you can't be if you are focused to a certain mission and dream, you can't, you know, you got to be working hard. You can't be like just do whatever you want. Or people who are impulsive can't really accomplish either great evil or great good, because they can't accomplish much of anything. They just follow whatever instinct it happens. He was able to control it to a large extent, because able to sell the idea of the franchise and ultimately purchase the land underneath all the McDonald's, which of course was the source of his big wealth. And of course, what is the error in the thinking that he made? It actually alludes to that. I don't know if he listened very carefully. His wife asked him an interesting question. When are you going to stop? When is it enough? Like, how many McDonald's restaurants is a sufficient amount of McDonald's restaurants? And he said,
never.
Yeah, I don't think ever, right. The limit, he had his eye had a limitless aspiration. He wanted it all. And therefore, at the end, one of the big things was that in order to get the McDonald's name from McDonald's Brothers, he made a deal for $2.7 million in 1961, which was a lot of money back then, but relatively. And they were offered, and he did a handshake of 0.5% of all profits, which he never honored.
Oh my.
He did on a handshake, and it's not really enforceable. So he just sort of,
people back then were very big into the handshake.
I understand that, but yeah, so he was a more, you know, there's a, you know, that's an immoral guy. Okay.
Put him out of business. He opened up one right.
And then he put, and then ultimately put the original McDonald's, because they had to change their name, and then he put them out.
Oh,
he had that, yeah, because he was a
narcissist.
Right. He couldn't eat. In other words, not only did he want to have the success, he wanted to have them to have failure.
Sounds like I was just going to say, Donald Trump.
Right. So the movie depicts. You know, a very interesting character. He's a very captivating character, but ultimately, let's call it a highly flawed character. Okay, what I want you guys to do now is to spend some time working through the source. This is a source on the topic of the man. Just as you guys, as Jews leave Egypt, 3 days in, they have no, a month in, they run out of the supplies, the provisions that came out of Egypt, where they ran out, okay? So it's like, you know, the middle of the next month of ER, they had nothing to eat. So Hashem speaks to them about that. Okay, so I want you to break into your chavrusa, i.e. people who are adjacent to you, and to look at it. All right, so then you guys.
Yeah.
And I'm going to share with you.
Yeah,
thanks.
That would be his.
I think we can.
Okay, so we have 16 circa. Let's go through them a little. Who'd like to read? All right, Anna, go ahead.
When the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "It is manna," because they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat."
Okay. So this food is obviously, they did not get apparently normal food. So they got this man stuff. And Moshe tells them, "This is what." All right. Okay. Good. So that's one thing. So you have a miraculous food. So that shows up in the morning here. Let's see. Then comes some of the rules attached to this. Okay.
This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one according to his eating capacity, an omer for each person, according to the number of persons, each one for those in his tents you shall take.
What is an omer?
It's a measurement of wheat.
Omer is literally they have a omer jug. It's a container. Basically, it's about 48 ounces. So they got the little omer container, stuff it with man. And how much man will they bring home to the tent?
The number of people that they have.
So if they have five people in the home, they bring home how much?
Five
omers. Five omers. Okay. Now, could they take more than one omer?
No.
Now, 17. Let's go on, Anna.
And the children of Israel did so. They gathered, both the one who gathered much and the one who gathered little.
Go on.
And they measured it with an omer, and whoever gathered much did not have more, and whoever gathered little did not have less. Each one, according to his eating capacity, they gathered.
Okay, so a very interesting thing happened. The person... feels a little anxiety and wants to bring home two omers worth of man. He showed up home. What did he have? One omer. Okay.
Was it really filling for them? Like, I mean, was that enough food?
Well, so we don't know what the... Yes, obviously God's not going to give them this amount of food that you're going to feel wildly starving from. That was sort of defeat the purpose because they were hungry before.
See, we thought the capacity meant like body weight. Person got more because it was what they needed.
Well, that's interesting. Because you should ask the question, in other words, each one according to his eating capacity, they gathered, the Hebrew is, they measured it with the omer unit, the container, that jar. And the one who gathered more, and the person who gathered more did not get any more. The one who was less, he didn't lack anything. Each person according to what he can eat to gather. So we'll have to get into that. What does that really mean?
If Hashem knew how much everyone was able to eat in that house.
Let's make it very simple. Let's make a round number. They got the 50 ounces of the man, which they had to eat for day. But it gets a little more. But we're not done yet. What other features?
Per person. Including tiny children. So a 9-month-old baby would get a 50 ounce.
Okay, good question. All right. I mean, a baby that's not nursing, a non-nursing toddler, let's say.
Right, but then that family.
Okay, let's see what's going on. But we're not done yet in the strange feature. Go on.
And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave over any of it until morning." But some men did not obey Moses and left over some of it until morning, and it bred worms and became putrid, and Moses became angry with them.
Yes. Okay. Go on.
They gathered it morning by morning, each one according to his eating capacity, and when the sun grew hot, it melted.
Okay. So let's talk about the omer. So the gathering the man, what was that? What challenge did the man provide a person, or just to visualize, if you were in the desert with the Jewish people and your job was to get your daily man, that's your food, okay? We'll tell you a little later on what it tastes like. The end, but the first one. But what are some of the challenges psychologically does the mon confront a person with? Okay, Shana?
There's no other food around, and there's no other source of food, so why should they only, or they may wonder, like,
they're allowed to eat other food.
One day.
So what's the problem? What's the problem with it? Take for one day. What else do you need?
What food will there be tomorrow?
They'll gather the next day.
But they don't know that. They don't know about the next day.
So therefore, what is it? So articulate. So what challenge does that provide?
Faith.
Right. It's a challenge to your trust that Hashem's going to deliver the man. Because you're out there in the wilderness. There's no 7-Eleven. There's no Prestides. There's no Zabar's. There's no nothing for hundreds of Trader Joe's, whatever your favorite store is. Anthony Burger, right? Now they did have cattle. They could eat their own food. No, they're not. They have some resources, but for miles, so they're depending on this thing. So what? So psychologically, what does that cause a person? The reverse is: has anybody gone to a Sam's Club or Costco?
Yeah.
Visualize you're standing out in the parking lot on a Sunday about 3:00. Look at the people coming out of the store. What are they coming out of the store with? Who can give a little more color? We'll get to you in a second. What? Be more specific.
There's 42 rolls of toilet paper.
you gotta have the mega, I think it's a 48.
Sorry. Make,
right. Well, actually, okay, but whatever option you do choose from, what must you buy it?
Bulk.
You must get, they have like their whole move is they sort of, for the theoretically alleged reduction, which is not always the case, you have to buy, not just a ketchup, but a 2 64 ounce container of ketchup with a little plastic handle to make it easy for you to schlep out of the store, right? You don't just buy, a loaf of bread. You get the double loaf of bread. You don't buy a box of cereal. Get the double box of cereal. Okay. Now, when a person schleps a stuff, you can only use it in suburbia, not be done in Manhattan, because as the famous Seinfeld, Kramer came back from Costco and he had this massive thing of toilet paper. He got it for a ridiculously cheap price. He had nowhere to do it. He made it part of his furniture. That became his the scene was he made it as the coffee table. Put a little sheet over it and became the coffee table. But how does a person feel psychologically? People who live in the suburbs, when you schlep all the stuff in, now most people have, typically in their basement, a special closet referred to as the Costco closet.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, these are educated people are non. These are people who are all city people.
It's like a storage room.
Is that right?
Storage room in the Kramer.
Right. Right. And how does as they're putting in their, their 14th box of spaghetti, their 19th can of tuna fish, there's a 17th box of Honey Nut Cheerios. And they cram that door shut. How do they feel?
Because they're going to
expired
food.
Safe.
Well, you'll say. Yeah. So my thought is that it stems from the idea of fear. Fear of not having, you can never have enough.
Right.
So it's like people who were once hungry, like maybe Holocaust specific, but like people who grew up with that idea of being hungry can always need
food
more.
Food scarcity.
Yes, food scarcity. At any point or whatever, no matter how much you have, you're always afraid that you'll never get another meal.
It'll go away.
It'll go away. So it doesn't matter how much you take today, tomorrow, and the idea that you might be able to get tomorrow, that's still not enough.
Correct. So basically, this mon experience would cause profound anxiety. Because basically, you eat for today. If you leave stuff over, it disappears. The fact that you see that there's so much energy that people who have space, nobody only buys food for that day. Typically, I mean, there are single people in Manhattan that only buy food for the day, but even that's rare. But at least a day or two, they'll have some supplies,
They do that in Europe.
What's that?
Because they have small fridges.
They have small, yes. Mm. Well, yeah, but they're constantly buying fresh fruit and vegetables.
Right.
For the day.
Europeans are crazy. Mm-hmm.
Right, but I'm just saying, but the idea, but the.
I'm saying it happens nowadays.
Yeah.
Very fun.
It's right. Fresh.
But okay, that's also true. But they're constantly shopping also.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But the thing is that this actually really is. It says later on in the when Moshe is reflecting back on the Jews 40 years in the wilderness, he says that the manna was really a trial, was a test.
Okay.
So now we're going to analyze what that. It was actually a multi-tiered test. It wasn't just a one thing that is God going to abandon them. That's one element. We're not done yet. Now, let's go to Apostle 22. Keep on rocking and rolling, then we'll get to some questions here.
It came to pass in the sixth day that they gathered a double portion of bread, two homers for each one, and all the princes of the community came and reported it to Moses.
Okay, so came Friday, suddenly there was a, there's double man. What's going on? Go on.
So he said to them, that is what the Lord spoke. Tomorrow is a rest day, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake whatever you wish to bake and cook whatever you wish to cook, and all the rest leave over to keep until morning. So they left it over until morning as Moses had commanded, and it did not become putrid and not a worm within it. And Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, on it there will be none. It came about that on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather manna, but they did not find any. The Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to observe my commandments and my teachings? See that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Let each man remain in his place. Let no man leave his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. The house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed. It was white, and it tasted like a wafer with honey.
Okay, so kind of like a waffle. Okay, now, all right, couple things. What is challenging about the man? What other challenge of the man? Just based on the plain text. Would you like the man? Would you like to go on a man diet?
No, it's the same thing every day.
Okay, boom, right there. If you go to any office in Manhattan around 11:20, the conversation is always the same. So, what are we doing today? We're doing Mexican? We're doing Thai? We're doing a little Japanese fusion? Did you bring your own thing? What do? What do you want to go out today? Going for a burger? Five napkin burger situation? Right, there's a whole conversation because basically, you know, most people at work are typically very bored. And the initial conversation, then what do you do when you're bored? You talk about food.
Yeah.
Because food is always interesting, especially when you're a little bit hungry. Okay? And even when you're not a little bit hungry. Okay? So there's a conversation about food and what kind of food, what variety, especially New York City, as we all know, has roughly 26,000 restaurants.
Wow.
26,000 restaurants on the island of Manhattan, not in the five boroughs. On the island of Manhattan.
How do you know
that? You can Google that later. Because I have no life. So the question is, now, why is such a, you know, and that's why when people are keep kosher and they tell their friend in the office, they're going to go like 4 blocks away to go to a restaurant. Like, why'd you go 4 blocks? Because literally, there's typically a Mexican, a Chinese, like the basic 5 to 7 varieties of things are within 1 block away. You have to walk 5 blocks? Ridiculous. What is that? What do you have to do for your religion? Ridiculous. 5 blocks with kosher food. Anyway, so the one of the second trials is that based upon the written text, everybody knows the matters about taste, like whatever you want to do. But leaving on the plain text that the
that
that
has
the, a, I'm
going to ask that.
Yes.
I didn't know that there was a Midrash.
It's the Talmud says it that brings the Midrash. Okay, but we're gonna get to that. We'll get to that shortly. But according to the plain text, it had a basic one flavor. It was not 31 flavors. It had one flavor. Okay? So that's also psychologically great. Okay, whatever. Pick your favorite food. Dan, what's your favorite food?
Probably a tasty steak.
Yeah, for sure. I knew you were going to say that. You know why?
Why?
Because you're a guy.
That's right.
That's actually, that's mine too.
Okay. But typically, guys, 10, you know, if I had asked 10 guys, at least 8 out of 10 guys would pick steak. But women, it would not be.
What would it be?
Are you going to say it's salad?
No. Don't
<say
it. laughs>
No.
It could be like a chocolate, like a sort of a pasta dish.
Pizza.
All right, I got it wrong. Okay. All right. Anyways, the point being, Chaim, you have a favorite?
No, I was just going to say my Rebbe, my Rosh Yeshiva used to say that the biggest chesed a person could do in the midbar was for a rich person to explain to a poor person what a good steak and what everything would taste like, so then they can go from their bread imagination to the idea of salivating over a big steak for the month.
Okay, right. But we're taking the, not the midrashic approach, taking the midrash that tasted had one uniform flavor.
But that's what I was.
Right. Correct. So. If you like steak, let's say you had a big, delicious, fantastically, perfectly grilled steak. So you had, let's say you had it tonight. You want to have it for breakfast?
No.
No. How about for lunch?
No.
So you're like you have one time you're done. You couldn't.
Well, I would have it the next night for dinner.
Right, because again, it's a heavy food.
Yeah.
Would you have it for a third night?
Probably
not. No. So no matter what, because basically, that's a quick question. Why do you need variety in food? Or if you have the caloric, if you have all the food as fuel, if you have the right amount of vitamins and, all the proper calories, in other words, the food as fuel element, why do you need to have variety in food?
I could do a burger or pizza all day long.
I don't think so. I call you on that one. I'm asking you.
Yeah.
Correct. The bottom line is it's a psychological need. Food has one part, it has the basic element to sustain you, and the overlay is the psychological satisfaction of the aesthetic or the food experience, different flavors, different tastes, different presentations. The entire food culinary experience is based upon that psychological phenomenon.
Plus
okay,
humans,
you
like
and variety. You're okay.
As humans, we like variety too.
Okay, but that's part of the psychological need.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you're like an astronaut and then you like the classic astronaut food, eating whatever that was back in the on the Apollo missions, it was disgusting. But that's how they can make sure that you don't die. So. So this is a this is another test. Not only can you not get the satisfaction of packing away the food overnight in your fridge, that your proverbial Costco closet, and if you tried it, it would get rotten. So even if you tried it, you're blocked. And number two, you didn't get the food satisfaction of the multiplicity of varieties. You didn't have the 29,000 restaurants to order from. And that's another thing in New York. You also have if money is no problem, you don't even have to get your lazy foot off the thing. Some dude will come, on a bicycle and then drive it up and go to your desk. When I first came to MG, 2006, I was working out Long Island. There's no delivery of food, certainly back then. Now, so literally it was like just the enjoyment of like a guy coming to your desk and giving you the thing. And eventually you realize you want to get out. And also realize that I'm getting fat and also I'm getting poor. So you stop doing that little practice. So that satisfaction, that psychological, so that again, they were also confronted with that. They could not indulge in that. No. Okay. Then we get to the third thing. What happened on Friday? They got a double portion. Why? Okay. So the Lechem Mishnah, the two loaves of bread, is to signify God helping them by giving them Shabbos food in advance and the element that it was not going to get, it was not going to rot. Okay. Now, this is where they're introduced to Shabbos via the mind. They're having like what they call a little mini Shabbos. What are the rules of the mini Shabbos?
Don't go out and gather.
Don't go out and gather.
Don't prepare.
Right. Don't cook on the Shabbos. Don't prepare the food on Shabbos, rather before.
Stay in your place.
And stay in your place. So it's a three rule. It's a three rule Shabbos. We call it like a proto Shabbos, a mini Shabbos. Why did Hashem start with a three rule Shabbos?
Yes, start small.
Okay, because the Jewish people are 1 month out of Egypt, and you have to start to get people to the essence of the Shabbos, without them, this is classic. This is where we get from MG. You don't start first like, here are all the rules of Shabbos. Read this and come back. No, you start off with like a little taste. Okay. The rules were: don't leave your place, don't gather the food, don't pair on shot. I would rather pair in advance. You got them all. Okay? I don't gather. All right, so they had one malacha. They had one of the 39 laws. They wanted don't gather the stuff. Okay, and obviously, and also not cooking it. So they couldn't. Okay. So, why did he weave the man into that? Why is, in other words, the man, the first week of the man, they got Shabbos. What's the idea here? Why would he, in other words, why have 1 week we're going to talk about man, and then next week we're going to talk about Shabbos. Why did you, 6 days they had the man, the first week, and then on the Friday they got double portion. They're a little confused about that, what's going on with that. And they're told about Shabbos. That was their first week, 1 month out of being out of Egypt, okay? What's the educational value of that? What is Hashem trying to teach the Jewish people?
That there's differentiation.
Between one what?
The regular day and the special day.
Correct. And what's the character of the 6 days?
Not working.
Right, so the 6 days you're involved in, taking care of your basic needs. Now, within your getting basic needs, but didn't say take care of your needs in any way you want. He even made a limitation on that. What was the limit? What was the limit that the Hashem instructed them in their questing for their needs? You should seek to get your portion. So, what is he basically trying to teach the Jewish people?
Don't be greedy.
Don't be a greedy bastard. Okay? As simple as that. In other words, you're there to take, or Hashem made the world, or you're special, but you know what? Not only are you special, but your friend is special also. Like Ray Kroc, for a moment, he felt that he was special, for sure, and at the expense of anybody else being special. And therefore, he felt very entitled to take away the person's wife and business and money and all kinds of nasty things. Or if he had his sense of specialness was in direct portion of everybody else's specialness. Here, the fact that everybody gets Omer says what? The Jewish people is everybody special, but your portion is not at the expense of the other guy. So, for example, we have moving it forward into Jewish law. So, for example, there's an idea of. The statement in the Talmud says, "Hamahapech becharara, ani hamahapech becharara, nikra rasha." You have a poor person who's going for the cookie, and before he takes it and takes possession of it, you go in there and do what? You swoop it out. So technically, you acquired it first. It was an owner thing. So similarly, let's say a guy's investing and does a lot of research on a particular property, and then you just zip in there and grab the property from the guy. Okay, I'm not going to go through all the halachic distinctions. Nikra Rasha, you're called a wicked person. Okay? There's a fundamental idea that we have a respect, Hakarech Moch, of loving your fellow Jew, is to be concerned about A, their emotional well-being, and to be concerned about their financial well-being. And understand that I have a portion, and they have a portion. And it's not right for me to go in and use aggressive tactics to try to screw them out of their stuff. I know it sounds like, no, it's like basic morality, all right? So Hashem is basically, the Jew or people are in 40 years in the desert, they didn't know it was going to be 40 years, but basically Hashem was training a new society. And so basically the man was, A, have to have conviction that Hashem is going to follow through. That's what everybody got. That was the easy one. That was the layup point. But not only that. Two is the idea of I can't indulge these psychological needs. Like, in other words, why do people eat? Psychologically. Give me a situation where a person eats psychologically. Oh, in other words, you're already full. You're not hungry. Who here has eaten when you're not hungry? Okay, every single day, all the time. Okay? Give me a situation where a person's typically going to eat. Okay, a person's feeling depressed. Like the classic movie scene. You see the girl on the couch who's been dumped with the big spoon, always a big spoon for some reason, and the ice cream. Right? Or the big bag of chips, or the chocolate, and always in front of the TV. Okay? There's different things. There's the depression thing. In other words, it's like the edible antidepressant factor, one. Second thing, what else? on board. So you feel this agitation, like you. Now, what is, what has everybody thought about, what is eating about eating and boredom? What do those things got to do with it? Because
you
can enjoy it. Why don't you say, oh, why don't I go for, why don't I go for a jog? Why don't I read a book?
It's easy and mindless.
Pleasurable.
No, because basically, being bored is a pain. In other words, when your mind has like nowhere to go, that's a semi-painful state. So you feel the underlying element is, I feel entitled. I should not be in that state. I should be in the continuous pleasure state. Therefore, what I do, I eat cookies and chips, crackers, pretzels, chocolate. Okay? I'm not saying I, but we, collectively, and I. Okay, so so that's a, and what else do you, when else do you when else does the person eat?
When there's an immense, a massive amount of choice at like a
cocktail hour. Right, so then there's the free food emotion, like,
yeah.
Right. Oh my gosh, this is awesome free food, like, you know, the right, that's another factor. Or you'll notice that, have you ever, like, at MJE, at the Kiddush, have you ever, you know, you've gotten your portion, your Omer's worth of chalent, but you hesitated. What do you suddenly feel pressing up against you in your back? Somebody else trying to move you aside for them to hop in and get their portion, right? Yeah. Or basically the etiquette, Kiddush etiquette is what? You get your food and you move away.
Yeah.
You go up.
Not here.
Right. First person, then there's always a person who's clueless who gets there and then who suddenly just, who stands right in front of the food and has a conversation like, dude. So as senior fellows, if I teach you anything, what is proper Kiddush etiquette? Get in, get back out. Get in, get back out. Okay? Because basically people have been in the shul penitentiary for a little too long and they feel entitled for a little food pleasure. And you're going to step in their way? Not a good idea. Okay? All right? So critical. So basically Hashem is actually putting them in rather tough boot camp situation where they have to eat food which is healthful for them, which really does not satisfy the psychological dimension. In other words, it's healthy, but it's not going to help them for feeling sad, feeling bored, feeling anxious, feeling depressed. Why? Is Hashem being mean? What's the value of putting that person in the state? And they have enough food.
Well, is it that he didn't want them to feel jealous of each other, that somebody got more than each other, to compare and want to be envious?
Okay, so I think that is a point as well. But the question is, why only, no, in other words, the food was basically food what you need. It's not food what you wanted to eat. They actually called it later on, they criticized the mom, they called Lechem Haklokel, this light, insignificant food. In other words, they were not happy with the mom. It got real old real quick. Okay, but there was really nothing else they can eat. So why is Hashem pushing, forcing them not to be able to get psychological, we're not aesthetics, we're not people that enjoy, there's no value intrinsically of being in a state of deprivation. There's no idea of being deprived for God. There has to be some educational utility of that. What is Hashem trying to push?
Humility.
Okay.
Because if they don't feel that sense of entitlement, then they're more, they feel, they learn what it means to be humble, to appreciate what they have.
Yes. So basically Hashem is trying to take people who are fundamentally culturally Egyptian and prepare them to receive the Torah in a couple of weeks and ultimately to start the Jewish people. So if you have people who are fundamentally Egyptian and you want to make them Jews, there has to be a little change. So you want to do that rather quickly. So the idea was to fast track them. They weren't going to be supposed to be in the, at this point, they're going to be in the desert for basically like a couple months. And then they're going to be into, actually even less, not even a couple weeks. And that would be it. This was not supposed to be a 40 year expedition. But basically Hashem wanted to force the conflict. He wanted them to sent to puncture that sense of entitlement. I should be continuously in a fluttered state. I should be able to have everybody's stuff is really mine. To be able to become humble. This is my portion. That's that guy's portion. I ain't taking his portion. I don't feel jealous of their portion. I don't, you know what I mean? I don't want to also, and I also, the lessons of all the lessons of the, which I want to present them, he didn't want them to be distracted by engaging in, you know, gorging themselves with food pleasure. Interestingly, when they get to the border, what do they demand? Hashem. Now you make perfect sense. They're at the border, in order, they got the Torah. Hashem said, all right, we're moving out. Okay, they were at Sinai. Okay, they're a little longer because they had a thing called the Golden Calf. We'll delay. They get to the border. They're about to go in. All right. They didn't have no more mana. They wanted something added to the menu. What do they demand? And they start to cry. Like they had a meltdown. What do they want?
Meat.
Give us meat. Why do they want the meat? In other words, why do they need the meat right now? Is this meat time? Well, guys, we're about to go into Canaan. About to launch the invasion. Why do they want the meat? Why do they want the meat? And are we having a pause for a barbecue? Is it Memphis barbecue time now? I don't think so. We're about to go into the land of Canaan. Why does someone say they start to cry? We want meat.
But they say it's like the hardest at the weakest, like at the very last hour, it's the most difficult before like the sun like comes out.
Okay, yeah. Why do they want somebody to have steak? I need to have meat. What's going on there? Nor is the conflict of them having to set up a Jewish people, a nation, fight the Canaanites. That is a source of what? Profound anxiety. If you don't want to deal with something, you want to do what? Gorge yourself in some yummy food. I mean, what will not solve the problem than a large plate of ribs? Okay? So you know what I'm saying? In other words, if they were in a state of the anxiety of the situation of having to now launch the Jewish people in the land of Israel, fight the enemy was a tremendous source of anxiety, and they had a whole meltdown. Okay? So it's all about the food. And Jews, by the way, it's all about the food. Okay? So that's the key element there. And then Hashem shared with them that food has another purpose. The food is to be utilized. You don't have to have it. Hashem is going to give you a gift. You don't have to run and gather the food. I'm going to give you the food and prepare it so you can have a Shabbat, which is a spiritual oriented day where you're free from 6 days of gathering. Okay? Everything's going to be prepared in advance. He's communicating what really is the goal of life, really. It's important to take care of your needs, but ultimately your material needs are really instrumental to your spiritual needs. And that's Shabbos. And he didn't put too many rules on it. You're not traveling, staying in and around the tent area. You're not gathering. And you're not cooking. That's it. Simple. Three rules. You know? But were the Jews able to do that? The first Shabbos, were the Jews able to keep the first Shabbos?
No, they didn't.
No, why not? How simple are three rules? They forgot a rule? Oh! I was good with two and three, but I kind of forgot one. I mean, what happened? And Hashem really is angry at them. And it came up on, this is verse 27, it came about on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather man, but there was none. We didn't find any. Hashem said to Moshe, how long will you refuse to observe my commandments and my teachings? So Hashem views it as being a tremendous violation, a big act of rebellion. Why did not all Jews, why did some Jews want to go out? He just gave you the food in advance. In other words, you have the man. It's in your tent. You don't need to go out. Chillax. Pull up a stool. Get comfy. What's going on? They had to go out. What is that? That really represents a rat race. I can't stop. In other words, when that's the Ray Kroc phenomenon. There's no limit. It's a new day. There might be more mine. I'm not going to be a sucker and not get the mine. A new client, a new customer, there's no end. That's what I'm trying to teach them. There's, you know, you have what you need. You're good for your family. You stop, because that's only instrumental good. That's not the ultimate good. That's a means, not the end. That's why Shem said that it's tantamount to what? Ignoring the entire Torah, even though the Torah didn't have. Because fundamentally, the person's just, their whole life is about a material quest to have as much stuff as they can grab, including other people's stuff. That's not a developed person. They couldn't stop. Shabbos, by the way, you see people, people who observe Shabbos, when do they sit still? When are they done preparing for Shabbos?
The minute before.
So you see that basically we're really addicted to work. One more email, one more text, one more thing. We love it. All right? We can't let go until buzzer stop. All right. That's why Rabbi Soloveitchik had the best line. He said, in America, we have many Shomrei Shabbos. But what I miss from Europe is there's not an Arab Shabbos Jew. What's an Arab Shabbos Jew? Person who appreciates what Shabbos is, and he prepares, and he's in a calm state walking into Shabbos. He's not like popping out of the shower 32 seconds before Shabbos, but he or she is ready. Everything is set. The place is clean. Table set. Everybody's dressed in advance. And walk into Shabbos calmly. That takes a really appreciation of what Shabbos is. I'm not saying, well, you know, first of all, your first goal is to be a Shomer Shabbos, you know, but the idea being is to appreciate that, to not just I'm doing Shabbos, but to appreciate the value and utility of Shabbos, the gift of Shabbos. We appreciate the gift of Shabbos. Hashem is really helping them out by saying it's game over. In American secular society, people are recognizing that the ability to have one day where you can turn this off is the most liberating thing. People are coming on to the obvious psychological and material benefits of Shabbos, at least from a technological side. No beeping, no buzzing, no texting, no emails, no games, no apps, no nothing. Just a sense even to sit calmly with yourself for a moment. It's tragically missing from our society. So let's, in conclusion, everybody's heard this phrase from Pirkei Avot, Epic of Father, who is rich? One who's happy in his portion. So I ask you, why aren't people happy in their portion or in their lot?
Because it's just not nature
to
always want what we don't have.
But why do we want what we can't want?
We think more is better.
Why?
Well, if we see, like, for example, like when the media is publishing, like every time that there's a new phone that come out and they always add something better. Oh, there's a better camera in it. Then we feel like we're lacking something. Oh, without that good camera, we won't be able to take good pictures, right?
It's true. Obviously, Madison Avenue and America, which is a consumer nation, constantly, the essence of marketing is to make the person feel that you are an inadequate person without my product. You're a big fat loser if you don't got my product. You're welcome to be a big fat loser, but you can remove that problem from my product. Okay? That's basically marketing. You know, whole course, I just gave you 10 seconds. That's the goal of marketing. You are deficient as a person without this property or product or service. Period. Which is oftentimes not true. It's occasionally a little true. Not that much. So a person's sense of what they need to be complete is distorted. But even before we had all that, intrinsically, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, it was still a problem.
Just the competitive nature of society and just...
Correct. So in other words, since, what Lisa's bringing up a major point, in other words, the nature of all people, man is a social animal. Okay? And basically, the animal nature of us is to be, to use an anthropological term, to be the alpha male or the alpha female. I want to be the big macher, the Yiddish term. I want to be the big man on campus. I want to be the prom queen, the quarterback for the high school team. I want to be the big man on campus. I want people to recognize that I am qualitatively superior to everybody else. So that sense of me to be better than everybody else means I have to, how do I demonstrate that I'm the better guy or better girl? I have more toys. I have more stuff. I have better clothes. I have better apartment. I have better this. I have better that. And if I can't get that, what do I do when I talk? What do I say about those people who do have more stuff? What do you say? What do we say about them? Are we happy for them?
No.
No, we're not. Right? No, we try to undermine their position. The way I like to express it is that, I mean, using two Yiddish terms, you have person's a macher, a Yiddish, a prominent person. Schlepper means a loser. There's a macher-schlepper continuum, and people's quest in life is to move up the macherometer and not slide down to Schlepperville.
But isn't there... isn't there merit in the idea of the people who find self-awareness and it's not? And I mean, that's a possibility.
That's what we're talking about. Person who's happy in their Porsche. In other words, I have what I need. And the fact that they have more doesn't bother me.
Can you be okay and happy in your lot and still want for yourself? Or are those two ideas not able to...
That's a contradiction.
No, but not in a comparison to somebody else. I'm happy with what I have. I'm content. I'm satisfied. On the day-to-day, I am satisfied. Right. But there are certain things and goals of my own ambition that I want to reach. Can you be both?
Things the desire to always keep growing also.
Well, we're not talking about material stuff, we're talking about goals for self-actualization. But if a person is really happy, we're talking about wealth. Now, where people in order, what the Pure Gables did here is they did a paradox. Who is wealthy? A person's got $50 billion. No. The person who is happy with what they have.
And is it wrong to want a promotion in your job?
No.
But that might give you more wealth.
No, if you say like this, I have a mission for my family. I want to provide them with X, Y, and Z, which I think is realistic. And right now, I'm not in that situation. So I'm not, Yeah. The reality is you're not wealthy because you feel in a state of lack.
What if I want the promotion in the job not because of money? What if I already have enough money, but I want the promotion because of the title?
So that's a lack. Why do you want it? So what? So I can say, oh, I'm the senior vice president.
What if I want to be the senior vice president so I could do good for the community?
Yeah, but typically, so just do good for the community. Or why do you need a title for that? Typically, a person wants a title because they want to be able to show that, see, I have this objective identification that I am awesome. And, a person's awesome is not dependent upon a corporate title. Yes?
So this point, the Zohar distinguishes between the desire to receive for the self alone and the desire to receive for the sake of sharing. So if I want more money so that I can get back more to the community or to others, that's a good thing. But if it's just for me, it's not. That's yet to her.
So, I mean, again, so what's, I mean, the in other words, there's no idea, for example, of, let's talk about Tzedakah for a moment. There's no idea I want to make more money so I can have more money for Tzedakah. That's baloney. There's an idea of a charitable person gives a certain percentage, let's say they deal 10% of their post-tax earnings to charitable things. I want to make another $1 million so I can give away $100,000. Or you have no obligation to do that. Just the opposite. You're moving your life. In other words, the more work, or you're spending less. If you have a time and energy, you want to be able to work on non-material things. Or it's a hassle enough to pay all the bills, right? But really, the goal is to try to expand the Shabbos amount. Another thing where you can spend time on learning, like try to get a little bit of Shabbos during the day. Like, hey, want to spend a little time learning or thinking about things that are not on my to-do list, give it to me by my boss. Or call me every 5 seconds.
More wealth can help you with that.
Say again?
More wealth can help you with that. I mean, being a Jew is expensive.
Yes. No, okay. I did happen to notice that. It's true. Being a Jew is expensive. So you're right. So your goal is I want to be able to take care of my, or if it's appropriate, then your question, I want to be able to take care of my needs. That's the right thing to do simultaneously. But at the end of the day, if I'm in my, the disaster is a constant questing for the prestige and the various extras that don't really have any merit. It's going to make your life more miserable. In other words, the rat race. So basically, Hashem ensures that 1/7 of your life, you have to get off the hamster wheel. You have to get off. Because we would be like those guys. You'd be right behind those guys on the seventh day, hopping the left of your mind. I have a nomer, but nowhere in half is more. So the man broke down all the core life lessons into a very elemental way. He's trying to, in a boot camp kind of way, teach Jewish people to not be Egyptians and to aspire to be really Jews. In other words, not be jealous of what everybody else has. Try to be happy with what you have, not what you fantasize, and then leave the rat race the 6 days a week, and then for the seventh day, at least be able to withdraw, and be able to think which are of a spiritual nature. That may not, basically, this is the essence of Judaism in a nutshell. Sure. Last two questions, we're going to we'll be done.
Well, I just wanted to make a point, it's not a question, but Moshe is really the perfect person for this because he's the one who gave up the posh life.
Yes.
Living in the king's palace to show them I had it all, and like, you know, I gave up all of that
for justice.
Exactly.
The help of a Jew getting deep. Exactly. Correct. That's, you can make that case strongly. Michael Penn closing out the night.
Yeah, a question.
Wait, it's a rabbi.
Hold on.
Question.
I got Michael Penn, and then I'll go to Yechaim. Yeah.
I have a question. The question, and this kind of went over my head. You said it earlier, but why did the Jews want the meat?
They wanted the meat because at that point, when you're about to enter the land, the anxiety level starts to rise dramatically. And just like when we feel anxiety, we want to stick our hand into a bag of chips. They wanted to have meat. They didn't want to trap themselves with a food pleasure, but they have to deal with the reality.
Gotcha. Okay? And then one thought is that lots, like people's lots, are constantly changing.
Yep.
Right? So it's like there's life, and to me, you know, it's human nature to want more.
Right.
And that goes back to Adam and Eve.
Yes.
And it's not wrong to want more, in my opinion. It's not.
It's, you know, I would say it is natural to want more, but you have to ask yourself the question, why do I want more?
Why?
To what end? What purpose? Do I want to be able to, I can walk into shul and tell, oh, by the way, I got a promotion. Do you want to name drop that? You know, like the classic question, you know, would you share with your friend that you got a bonus? If you did, why would you want to share that? Okay. We got to go. I don't want to, I have the rule, thou shall not go overtime. Have a great night, guys. Guys, have a good night.
Whoa.
Chaim, you're on. Last guy. Everybody's leaving.
Good night. Yeah.
Good night, everybody. Go back to Machiavelli, everybody. what's it called? Special Mike Penn. Mike Penn?
Mike.
No. Wait. So seriously, the question. Why does this have to? Why didn't it have to be 40 years in the desert? Why couldn't they learn this in 1, 2, 7, 10, 20 years? Why did it have to go that many generations?
Right. So the idea was this was to be only for like a couple of months.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Then they had the Agel. Then they had the Meraglim, and then that's when it all fell apart. The answer was, it was supposed to be a short-term project, and then they failed so many times, it got elongated to a long-term project.
But they didn't fail in this.
They flunked the grade.
But they didn't fail in this aspect, specifically.
They did, as well, yes.
Because wasn't there, because in Nubby, like, didn't somebody have to, like, they kept the mud in a jar for years for everybody to see over and over?
Yeah, Hashem told Aaron to gather mud to be an eternal mountain monument.
So
that was supposed to, as a testimony to the Mon experience, because there's a lot of lessons encoded in the Mon. The Mon is sort of a paradigm of lots of ideas. All right, I got to go teach another class, guys. So, Laila Tov.
Thank you.
Laila Tov.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.